Hello, and thank you for downloading this Conversations podcast. If you don't already subscribe, you can do it completely free of charge. It's easy. Details are on our website, abc.net.au/conversations, or just look for Conversations with Richard Feidler through iTunes.
Conversations with Richard Feidler on ABC Local Radio.
Hello and welcome to Conversations. In April 2001, Christine Nixon became Victoria's Chief Commissioner of Police. And this put Christine Nixon in charge of an organisation of 12,000 or so people, with a budget close to $1 billion, with over 2,000 cars and maybe 8,000 guns, as she says. Christine Nixon began her career, though, in the New South Wales Police Force in another age. After she graduated from the Police Academy, she was fobbed off for a while on traffic duties and school outreach programs, but in time she rose through the ranks as part of a group of reformers. When she became Victoria's Chief Commissioner of Police, she encountered a strong opposition from within the police and media, who feared that she might instill a, quote, soft, feminised police culture. Now, this is an argument that had been going on in police culture between reformers and traditionalists for years and years, and it really does come down to the question, what do we want the police to do for us anyway? Christine Nixon remains a controversial figure. The secretary of the Victorian Police Association says she's been rightly criticised, quote, for what she did to the police force in trying to turn it into something that she thought would have been lovely for everyone. In effect, she emasculated it, and for the appalling way in which she didn't deal with the state's biggest ever crisis on Black Saturday. But her publisher describes these critics as a coalition of hardcore recidivist police who are resistant to change, opportunistic politicians adept at the dog whistle, and a tabloid media both stoking and profiting from resentment and ignorance. Wow. But the controversy over a meal on Black Saturday has crowded out the rest of her remarkable life story. Christine Nixon's memoir is called Fair Cop. Christine Nixon, hello.
Hello, Richard.
I don't think I've ever been able to read such comments about a guest in the past. What do you think when you hear all that?
Well, I have to say my publisher spoke those words when the book was launched. You know, I was a bit shocked. I thought, gee, this is she's going to have a go here. And she did. And I thought that was an interesting perspective. And I think, you know, I wished it wasn't so controversial, some of the things that I've done and my career, I suppose. But I guess that's just the way it's turned out.
I suppose that's just the very nature of the job and the job you do. You're dealing with, as a former commissioner, you're dealing with crime, and this is a very emotive thing and a thing people feel very, very strongly and powerfully about.
Yeah, they do, and they have opinions about it. I think that's the sort of important part, that it's a bit like teachers, I suppose, that everybody went to school and they've all got an opinion. And I think in terms of policing, you know, it's such a critical part of our community that many people have a view about it. And I think that's fine. But I guess what I've, learned over time is it's also about the research and the evidence. And I think, you know, that's the piece we should be looking at, about what does work with policing, not just what people think might work.
How do you view your tenure as Chief Commissioner now? You like to cite that it's been a success as Chief Commissioner.
Yeah.
What figures can you point to?
I understand that, Pete. I think when you come into an organisation like Victoria Police, I wanted to understand from the government what they wanted from the police, what the members of the organisation thought was the kind of issues that they needed to be worked on and fixed that would enable them to do the job better. And, of course, the community, you know, needed to tell us what it is they thought we should work on. So I suppose what I did was put that together by listening to, you know, thousands and thousands of people and getting an agenda to go forward with. So we set ourselves some goals. And, you know, I guess, you know, you can be judged on many things, but my view was that, you know, the issues around reducing crime, around reducing deaths on the road, around improving the community's trust in Victoria Police are all kind of evidence-based. And I think, you know, all of those figures turned out to improve and to, I think, you know, make it a better place. I mean, people stopped leaving Victoria Police. Members did. And we had a lot more people join us and you know, were attracted to policing. And I think, you know, we tried to work on a whole lot of issues perhaps that different parts of the community want us to work on. So, look, I still look back on it as a positive time. Lots of things, you know, that should have got done. Lots of things happened. I mean, I had, you know, you've looked at the book. It's got counter-terrorism issues. It's had the Commonwealth Games. It had corruption. All of those challenges were just thrown in as well to the job.
Yeah, it wasn't boring.
No.
Wasn't boring.
No, not by a long
shot. You forgot to mention the gangland war in there as well.
No, I forgot about that.
Because it's easy when you're going through things like that to forget things.
Sorry.
I suppose. But you grew up, you were a policeman's daughter. Your father was quite a distinguished policeman in his own right. Did he like the idea of you joining the police?
No, not particularly. I think when I first approached him over it, you know, those days, 72, you know, there were very few women in the police at that time. And I think he'd sort of seen that women had had a bit of a tough struggle just, you know, to even get the numbers. You know, there were very, as I said, hardly any of them. So I think he thought that would be one of my problems, that, you know, what the job's future would look like, whether or not it would be interesting for me. And I think the second part is he'd been a bit of a reformer himself, been a member of the association and been on the executive, as well as, you know, was sort of in his own sort of world of forensics, reforming a lot of processes. And so I think he felt like some of that might come back on me. And so I think he was a bit protective as well.
There was another alternate universe where you could have risen to the very top of Coles supermarkets.
Yeah.
Why didn't that happen, Christine?
Well, it's an interesting thing, you know, and I have said to the CEOs of Coles on occasions, you know, I could have had your job, actually, but whether that would have turned out is a whole other question. I'd worked from when I was a kid, you know, 14-year-old, part-time, you know, just as we did those days on Saturdays and school holidays. And so I'd kind of worked...
Shelf stacker or checkout chick?
Well, no, we didn't have checkouts in those days in the kind of Coles I worked in. It was a variety store and you had counters and tills on the counters. And maybe you're a fair bit younger than I am.
I'm just vaguely trying to picture that in my childhood. I'm just don't
well,
try to go that far back.
It was certainly there. And, you know, you used to have cafeterias and those sorts of things in the Coles variety stores. Anyway, I worked there, you know, and gradually got to you know, work on all the counters, and then eventually they sort of figured out I was reasonably smart and maybe I could do the pays and maybe I'd work in the office on holidays. Anyway, eventually all that came to a point where I thought, gee, maybe I could apply for their management program. They had a program where young men, I used to see them all the time, would come in as assistant managers and sort of stay at the store for a while and then head off to, you know, I don't know where else, but headed off somewhere. So I thought, gee, I could be one of those. And of course I then said, I think I'd like to be considered for your management program. And they kind of looked at me like, are you serious? We don't have women in the management program. Oh, okay. You know.
It's pretty funny, I suppose, in the long run, the New South Wales Police Force was more progressive.
Strangely enough.
Goals. So you went to New South Wales. The larger part of your police life is in Sydney, which is interesting,
it is,
I think.
Yeah.
You went to the New South Wales Police Academy. How many other women do you remember were in that year?
The year I joined, there were six women who were hired by the New South Wales Police, and they were really hired because others had left. So there was a quota. You could only have a certain number, and I think it was 130 at the time. So six was a big deal. And in the class I was actually in, there were two of us. And, you know, I went into the academy and it's, you know, the old Redfern Academy as it was. And I kind of looked about, there's got to be another woman here somewhere because I knew there was one other girl in the class.
Your first assignment to me reminds me, reading about this in the book, reminds me of the opening titles of Charlie's Angels, the 1970s, you know, where Kate Jackson and Farrah Fawcett Major graduate at the top of the academy and then go off directing traffic. You actually did direct traffic.
Absolutely. And of course we finished in December and so that meant that we had to join a whole bunch of our colleagues in the city in Sydney, and some people, you know, who were that age might remember, but we used to, you know, direct traffic, and mostly you try to get the pedestrians out of the way of the cars. And in my case, I got to look after the loading bay at Grace Brothers. And so, and occasionally, you know, venture forth if the traffic got really stuffed up to try and unstuff it so that people could get about their Christmas shopping. So we did that. And for hours on end in the heat and in the rain or whatever it was, and that was my introduction to policing.
Looking back now, trying to put yourself back in how you thought back then, did you see yourself always doing those limited roles that were available for women police, or did you think, oh, I'm going to get jack at this and try and expand this.
No, look, I didn't mind it. I mean, I know that it sort of sounds a bit strange, but it was new and it was a bit different, and we were a bit unique. There were very few of us, and so it was kind of something. I went, oh, this is okay. I can do this for a while, and so I didn't really think a lot about it as to what else there was, and that eventually came over time. But I quite liked teaching kids. I quite liked talking to adults. But I was sort of always thought in the back of my mind there was this: is this really kind of what I want, and is this the kind of thing women should be doing? And so I suppose it gradually dawned on me, but I didn't mind it for a couple of years.
There have been a lot of snide headlines about you over the years, but the first one was right in the Police Association magazine about you wanting to get wear earrings. Yeah. What was the headline, do you remember, about?
We had a women police branch that represented all of the women in the force at the time, and they kind of collected us all up so we'd all be together. And I remember for some unknown reason I became the president of that branch. One of the women who had been sort of went to have a baby, and kind of I got the job. I think no one else wanted it, and I was this silly 21-year-old. But anyway, we were looking to bring about a lot of things, reform on maternity leave, and obviously expanding the number of women and the number of roles. But one of the ones was a really simple thing, which was we wanted to wear studs in our ears, just the simple sort of gold
sleep.
Sleepers. And we wrote to the Police Association to help us lobby the management to do this. And anyway, there on the front page of the Police News, which is, the paper that goes out regularly, was Police Women Want Studs. And I went, yeah, that's it, guys,
Police Women Want Studs.
Yeah, that's it, And it's such an obvious kind of inferences. And that was, I thought, gee, they really do take us seriously, don't they?
Even to the launch of your book, there was the headline that the Australian had, PM skirts Christine Nixon country. Yeah. There's always these kinds of headlines, aren't there?
There always are. And, everything you see, or Christine Nixon gets a just desserts, around some of the issues. There's often, and I think, people have said to me over the last while, you're paranoid, I think I'm not paranoid, I just guess I see the obvious.
There were unreconstructed men at the time, but there were the dragons too. Tell me about the dragons. Do you remember them?
I remember them as it was really interesting, and it took me again a long time, when I kind of got older and wiser to recognise. But these were some of the senior women who were really managed the police. The women were managed by women mostly. There were some men there, but pretty much these were the senior women, and there are very few of them. They were the sort of inspectors level, because you'd only have however many women you had, you can only have so many sergeants and so many inspectors. And so these were the women. I think one was a first class sergeant, the other two were inspectors. But I always saw them as the sort of ones who were trying to stop us achieving,
Why
expanding.
Why would they do that? Why?
Well, it took, again, age and a bit more sort of, generosity of spirit, I guess I saw that they were of their time. And, they believed that they had pushed barriers, and they had. They were very smart. They could have run anything, actually. But they, as they saw it, had achieved the pinnacle of their careers to be in these senior positions. And what they saw people like me doing was kind of pulling that apart and not recognising, I think, the what they came with. And so, I kind of casually as a 23-year-old, used to refer to them as the dragons, and, got a bit older and perhaps was seen as one myself as time went on,
Christine Nixon is my guest in conversation today, former Chief Commissioner of Police in Victoria, who actually had most of her policing career in New South Wales. Her memoir, which she's written with journalist Joe Chandler, is called Fair Cop. You went from there to criminal investigation and working on cases. This was the role for women police in those
That's
days,
right.
Women who'd been sexually assaulted.
You did
children,
sort of two
runaways.
Things. One was the traffic duties and lecturing kids, and the other was in fact taking sexual assault statements or dealing with runaways. And it was really, for me, the first time I'd sort of, I suppose, been exposed to young women who were, runaways. And because I used to chat and I got to sort of understand them a little better. And I suppose it was for me having to confront for the first time, really, these young women and sort of say, well, why don't you go home? And they said, well, why would I? And in many cases, they had been the victims of sexual abuse. And this is in the 70s, and we weren't talking about, we talked about stranger danger in those days, but we weren't talking about the fact that young women, young girls particularly at that stage that I was dealing with, were often abused by people.
Yeah, what cases do you really remember from that time you can talk about?
Well, there was, a particular one case where we came to understand that this fellow turned out to be the father of these three young girls, had been sexually abusing them and actually taking photographs. And so we were...
How did that come to your attention that
you've
been doing that?
We worked in what was the Women Police Office. And so what happened is that a pharmacist had called the local police when the women in the store had actually looked at the photographs. And people used to do that because, you know, you put your camera reel in to be processed. And so the women had looked at the photos. And I have to say, because one point in my life I'd actually worked in a chemist for a short time, and we used to do that too. But anyway, in this case, what had happened was we saw the photos. The pharmacist had called the police, local police, and they then called the Women Police Office to come with them, because that's actually the kind of things that Women Police dealt with. And so we went out, of course, and with the photographs, and I suppose, you know, dealt with it. But it was the start. You know, we used to see continuously the number of cases of abuse like that, and in this case it was incest. And you also then saw, you know, sexual assaults. I mean, I tell the other story in a book about the number of times you deal with someone who'd been sexually abused, and basically there was nothing, you know, there wasn't doctors that were trained to deal with it. There were, you know, always the accusations that the woman had sort of asked for it or been in the wrong place. And I remember thinking about one woman, which, you know, she was kind of a strong religious background. And I thought, gee, you know, maybe once we might actually be able to win a case here. You know, it's just, and I suppose for me all of that meant that I came to just really be very sympathetic and understand the kind of, you know, what young women, and in some cases, obviously over time, men were confronting in terms of some of the sexual abuse and you know, that whole way they're often abused by people they knew.
You lobbied long and hard with some other women for women to be assigned to general policing duties, and eventually for your sins... You got to go to, of all places, Darlinghurst. Darlinghurst Police Station. Right, for people who aren't familiar with that part of Sydney, we should explain one of the most colourful parts of Sydney as it was back then.
Certainly. Still reasonably colourful, I think.
Still pretty colourful, yeah. Once you were assigned to that station, what were some of the things you'd see coming in and out of that doors that place on a Saturday night? Because you were behind the desk to begin with, weren't you?
We were. Yeah. And actually, we were in the switch room, which is just like behind the desk. And it was kind of seen as, well, you know, you girlies think you're going to actually get out there and work operational policing. Well, no, you're not. You're going to actually, you know, answer the switch. And as it turned out, we sort of went, okay, we'll learn. And, you know, you learn a lot when you're in a place like that. And so, you know, well, it would be 80 prostitutes a night would be arrested. So you'd see them all come in, and because we had to search them, and you get to know them. You know, other people would sort of drunks and gambling. Sometimes they'd do a raid, and, you know, they'd bring in 50 gamblers playing some card game or other. But, you know, it was a place also where the criminal investigation branch used to charge fairly heavy criminals. But the other people you used to meet was people on bail. So that every kind of morning and night, people who were reporting on bail twice a day would come to report. And so, you know, you got to meet them as well. And so I suppose you got to, you know, see lots of people. It was a big station. A lot of people worked there. And for some reason or other, which I never really kind of figured and twigged for some time, is I used to work weekends and nights. You know, I think I worked 14 weekends in a row. And I never woke up to the fact. I just thought, oh, this is really exciting and interesting and I'm learning stuff. But really, you know, what they were trying to do was kind of, get out of here, you know. You know, we don't want you to be here. And anyway, but eventually that all, you know, they became protective of us, I think, and the men I worked with kind of went, well, if, you know, you're doing the job. And I mean, mind you, we're still inside at that stage, but, you know, eventually we made our escape and were able to work outside.
We know now that, you know, Darlow in the 70s was full of pretty heavily entrenched police corruption. Mm. What happened when you saw that? What did you make of it when you saw that taking place?
Well, I think from our sort of view at that stage, you know, inside the sort of station and in the switchboard space, I'm not sure we saw a lot of it. I think that's the point I've seen. You know, you didn't sort of see people handing over money. You saw things, you could go, something's going on here. And, you know, so you knew those sorts of things. But I guess there were, you know, it's also about what you did about it in those days. And I think that what I came to understand is that there wasn't much you could do. You know, there was an internal affairs type organisation, but I guess I only ever saw the innuendo of it and sort of understood that it was going on. But I have to say I was never confronted, you know, straight up to me over it.
Would you go out and patrol?
Eventually we did.
Were you given a gun?
Only after a while, because we didn't have guns issued to us. They had a 5-shot, and of course we didn't know how to carry it. And
when you say us, you mean women, don't you?
Yeah, the three of us, yeah. Well, the women, we didn't get guns to start with. And sometimes if they give you a gun, you put it in your handbag. And it wasn't a bad weapon, really, in your handbag. But it was, you know, those were the days. I remember working with a young young constable once, and he was 21, so he was about 3 or 4 years younger than me. He had a gun, he had a bat, and you know, and wanted to take charge because he was a bloke. And eventually we got guns, and eventually we got properly sort of equipped to be able to use them too.
You wanted to become a detective.
Mm.
Why couldn't you?
Well, I had done a lot of work. Once they let us out of the station, you know, you could not do work in Darlinghurst. It was just, there was so much to do. And I went up and talked to the detectives in the local, you know, in Darlinghurst detectives, and some of them who I'd got to know and had a respect for said, yeah, we'll help you, you know, put the applications together. But when I kind of went down and saw the senior women who we were still connected to, they went, you're not going there. And I think probably in hindsight it was about protecting me. Darlinghurst detectives were fairly, you know, as it turned out over time, numbers of them got jailed and charged with different offences and left under suspicious circumstances. So I think maybe that was part of it. But what they then offered me, of course, was a shortcut, you know, and said, well, you know, you've done a fair bit of police work now. Why don't you just go into the detectives course? And I went, no, I actually want to learn. I need to go out, you know. So there was no suggestion I might go to another station and, you know, learn there at another place. It was more, you know, it's that way or the highway, really.
Christine Nixon's here, former Chief Commissioner of Police in Victoria. Her book's called Fair Cop. It's her memoir, her story of her life in the New South Wales Police and her role as Chief Commissioner of Victorian Police. Were you ever scared on the job?
Oh, I think you're silly if you're not. I think there were occasions.
Can you think of moments when you were... I
remember going out to a factory that had been broken into, and we knew they were inside, and there was like two of us. Nobody else had turned up to kind of help yet. And I thought, well, either we're going to sit out here or we're going to have to go in there and find them. And,
when you say two of us, you mean two women or you and another male officer?
No, bloke. No, they never let the women work together. It was always with another male officer, and which I didn't mind. It was okay. So what happened is we sort of, you know, you sit outside these premises thinking, what am I going to do here? You know, it's clearly been broken into. We're going to have to go inside. Anyway, we eventually did go in and arrest the people. But you do kind of get your hackles up. You know, you do. There are other sorts of instances, I guess, where you sort of think, what am I doing here? And, you know, is this a safe place? And so you follow your instincts a lot.
Have you ever had to physically defend yourself on the job?
No, never really. I mean, you know, I mean, I always had this wonderful capacity, you probably can see now, to talk and to try and work people through. And I think, you know, those operational times and others that I talk about in the book in terms of eventually, you know, working at the Bathurst races and, you know, different sorts of circumstances that I worked in, you know, generally, you know, I learned a lot. One of the things I watched at Darlinghurst was, you know, I watched young, you know, energetic sort of, you know, big police folks get into trouble in the sense of physically, and I watched the older, calmer, wiser heads who seem to not get into trouble. So I watched and behaved like the older ones.
Tell me a bit about that, about that role of the police. A police officer has to be several things at once. I mean, a large part of the job is cleaning up messes from people who ought to know better. A lot of the time, I sort of understand that now, I think.
True.
And sometimes it means stepping in into dreadful, truly dreadful situations.
Yeah.
But a good police officer is also a diplomat, too.
No, they are, absolutely. And I think that's the piece that gets a bit lost. And it did used to get lost in the early days, and I think more as time's gone on into the 80s and the 90s and now. I think what you see is the smart, wise, problem-solving police officer is the one that's kind of, you know, been drawn into prominence. And I think that sort of sense of the diplomat. You know, you find yourself in circumstances sometimes and you just, you know, you've got to negotiate your way. And, you know, at least you've got a kind of an overwhelming force to go with you to help you, you know, then you're pretty much always going to have to negotiate your way through it. And, yes, the force is an important part in some occasions. And I think, you know,
I know at one point you walked into a hill of bikies at Mount Panorama during the big motorcycle Grand Prix, I think it was, or something like that.
It's just the motorcycle races.
Essentially. And you made the decision to actually sort of go up and say hello to everyone before things got out of control. Did that actually help, though?
I don't know, really. I mean, it seemed like a good idea at the time.
Couldn't hurt.
It was one of those things, you know, it was the strangest thing. We had the police were sort of based in the hill, but it was more of a, you know, there till about, I don't know, 8 o'clock at night, or I think something like that. But But it seemed like it was, you know, we're just going to try and work our way through here. And they'd come in with, you know, bits chopped off and singed and, you know, a whole range of sort of states these bikies were in.
But, bits chopped off?
You know, well, yeah.
Ears or
oh, yeah,
noses?
Just lots of things like that. And the ambulance people were close by with us. But it was kind of one of those things that you just, you know, tried to negotiate a way through. Eventually, of course, what happened was it became, you know, the police were in a fortification, you know, on top of the hill. And but, of course, the women had been departed company by then. But I remember one year we worked at the car races and they took a lot of old senior sergeants and a lot of women up to try and just kind of settle things down. And actually, it didn't do too badly.
Christine, you were mentored for a while by John Avery, the great reforming police commissioner in New South Wales. You were a policy advisor to him as he was in charge of police education. And just tell me a bit about John Avery and his figure and his significance in reforming the police force/service in New South Wales.
Look, I think, I was extraordinarily lucky that sort of as one of those doors that shuts and another one opens, I ended up, you know, working for John Avery. And I think he was really very much at the forefront of having police think about what it was they did and the changes that were going on around us. So John had got a master's degree at Macquarie University and had written a thesis, which was really this sort of model that for me has been underpinned my whole sort of time, I guess, since in policing, was around, you know, how did you manage to kind of balance up that the sort of the force or service? And I think, you know, he was a strong advocate for it during the time in New South Wales.
You went out to do a degree full-time while you were working full-time not sleeping or something, I don't know. Then was offered a scholarship to go to the United States, a prestigious Harkness Fellowship to the JFK School of Government at Harvard University. What did you learn there that you didn't know before?
Oh, look, I had an amazing time there. I mean, I learned a lot about public policy. I learned a lot about leadership. I learned a lot about organisational change. And I guess it was reinforced about the kind of behaviours and the kind of processes and systems John Avery was putting into place that, you know, the model he was talking about was a new model of policing around the world.
Listening to Conversations with Richard Feidler. On air, online, and on digital. Subscribe to our free podcast service. Details on our website, abc.net.au/conversations.
My guest today is former Victorian Police Commissioner Christine Nixon. Her memoir is called Fair Cop. Now, we were talking there about you going to JFK School of Government at Harvard there. What did you learn there about what you need to do to bring change to a large and powerful institution?
Look, I think I learned it from two different aspects. One was with I call Ron Heifetz, who was teaching leadership and it was called Leadership and the Mobilisation of Human Resources, which is all a bit sort of, you know, long title. But he was really at the cutting edge, I think, of thinking about, you know, how did you get people to be part of the change?
So how do you do it?
Well, I mean, you involve them in it to start with. And I suppose I watched that in New South Wales when John Avery became the commissioner and then started to look at reforming New South Wales. I mean, he had to deal with the corruption issue and so much of the sort of first 2 years, I think, of his time was really focused on that. But then it was about thinking about, you know, the kind of evidence about policing, what worked in terms of what strategies worked in policing. And I think John Avery then decided there were kind of a range of us were somewhat his disciples. You know, for want of a better description, he picked people from an enormous range of backgrounds, very experienced police in some cases and me and others, you know, a range of people to be part of going out, talking to the members about how did you improve policing on the ground? What would you be doing differently? And so I suppose what I learned at Harvard was that sense of involving people. I mean, what I learned also was, and it kind of came out in a Telstra study a while later, was that what people want in an organisation is they want someone to know where they're going in the big picture. They want to know what's my bit, what do you want me to do? And they want to know, and they want some support to do it. Not complicated. And I guess that's what John Avery, I think, was advocating.
You don't need a year at Harvard to figure that out, do you?
Well,
you don't need all that,
actually think people need some lifetimes in some cases to figure it out. But, you know, and so I guess, you know, that was what I learned and a lot of other things, because I also got exposed to some of the best police chiefs around the world who were there as part of a sort of a forum, I guess, to think about what was the sort of best ways for policing. And
yeah, now this was at a time when there was a revolution in the philosophy of policing, I think, wasn't there?
Yeah.
And and in the United States, police commissioners came forwards like Bill Bratton in New York, who had the idea of zero tolerance. That was bandied around quite a bit. You get rid of the things like graffiti. You get rid of graffiti, and the presence of graffiti is a kind of a license for bad behaviour.
The people who were advocating most strongly was a guy called James Q. Wilson, who talked about the notion of broken windows, which means if communities start to sort of fall apart, if the environment around it, if people break minor laws, then that's when you start to see the sort of falling apart of our communities.
There's a lot of truth in that, isn't there?
Well, there is. Yeah. No, there is. And I think he then, advocated. I mean, Bratton had one view of it. I think he did more than simply, have people go and get arrested. He got thousands of more police officers. I mean, they'd had 25,000 police in New York in the 90s and ended up with 45,000 police. So he put a lot of police on the streets and they're still there.
On the other hand, you never know whether his success in New York and indeed the dropping crime figures in Australia is simply due to the long boom we had, the long period of economic growth where there was much less unemployment and it was much easier for people to make a quid.
Oh, look, I think, that's always a piece of that kind of change that's around you. But I think he did drive reform and accountability. And that was something I think was also a big change for policing, was really being held accountable for delivering in particular areas on reducing crime. And I think that's what I saw. And so I suppose the Harvard experience and then watching and learning from people over time, for me was something that sort of underpinned, I guess, what I did as time went on.
I love the fact you went with your mum back in Australia again to see a tarot card reader. And it being a typical manager, like you did something kind of irrational, going to see a tarot card reader, but being a typical manager, you got the reading and said, I'm going to make it come true. Tell me what the tarot card reader predicted was in your future, Christine Nixon.
I don't know if I then went out to make it true.
Well, you did. Richard. You did.
Well,
it's
it
in
happened,
your book.
But, maybe that was about the tarot cards. I guess they said two things, really. One, that I would wear a different insignia on my shoulder. And from the New South Wales Police, and I thought, well, maybe, they might change the badge at some stage. That was possible. And the other was, of course, that I would end up, meeting someone who was a bloke who was older than me, and that, that would be the future, and that I would also live in the country, in a sense, in a rural setting, and particularly in the Blue Mountains. And
now,
I went.
Now, none of these made sense to you at the time.
No,
because you couldn't see leaving the New South Wales Police Force. You decided that you were married to the job, didn't want to meet a bloke, and you couldn't bear the idea of living in the country.
That's it.
So then, bang, you went out, looked for a property in the Blue Mountains. You got it. Found a bloke, John, been married to him ever since, and became Victorian Chief Commissioner, Chief Police Commissioner.
What does that say?
It says you're a classic manager. It says, I'll make it happen now, doesn't it? I mean,
I have never had anybody suggest to me, Richard, that that's actually what
happened. It's there in the book.
My father, when he read that piece of the book, went, oh, no, you didn't tell people that, did you? And my mother, of course, said, see, I told you, there were things to learn that we don't quite know about. But yes, Richard, that all happened.
Okay, so you're rising through the ranks of the New South Wales Police, and there was the Wood Royal Commission into police corruption, which was really fascinating at the time. Fascinating stuff. Chuck Fowler, slip milkshakes and all that. A lot of quite entertaining in lots of ways too, and for all of its horribleness. What was your view of that at the time? Because you appeared in Parliament, along with a lot of others, to give the impression that you would be opposed to one.
That's true. And I still look back at that and wonder. I mean, what happened is I had only just become an assistant commissioner when they announced the Wood Royal Commission. In fact, I think it was about 3 days later that Parliament did that, and so I was brand new. The first woman, obviously, ever in New South Wales to become an assistant commissioner. And the commissioner called on me at the time to go with them to down to Parliament because they understood there was going to be a vote. And so I think 20 of us, I think the senior management team went down to Parliament, stood around in the visitors gallery.
That's not good. That's something.
It's not.
The presence of police officers, glaring down at the proceedings of the democratically elected Parliament is a bit creepy, isn't it?
It is, and I couldn't agree more. And I remember thinking at the time, this is not right, but that's part of a process, and I did it, but whether we were involved or not, the Wood Royal Commission went ahead and it did in fact start to its proceedings. And I have to say at the end of it, and for I think a whole range of reasons actually, I think the Wood Royal Commission did an outstanding job. And they did listen to us as an organisation. They listened to some of us within. I talk about a submission that I made with a range of colleagues around what reform in policing would look like. And they also held what I thought was a terrific examples of sort of round tables, closed round tables, where they brought the union along, they brought senior management along, they brought some experts along and facilitated that with a really good manager himself, from a businessman, and kind of came out with recommendations that were longer term, were about reform. Yes, they went for people and wanted to arrest them, but they also looked at things like, you know, the drinking culture in policing and how did you stop that? You know, random breath testing was a part of that. Education, that police officers should get an education, so they directed reforms to say that should happen. So I think there was a lot of reform and change they looked at, I think, you know, really well in the end.
I know many of the critics of the reforms at the time said that this resulted in a process-orientated police force rather than an outcome-focused police force out of all that. What's your view on that?
No. Rubbish. Look, I think that it was. Some people didn't like it because it was really starting to look at bringing better management, choosing people who could get more senior roles, you know, over time, because, you know, of their skills and their capacities. And I think that's what some people didn't like. And I think the accountability focus as well, really about. So you're in the Wood Royal Commission was the 90s, so you're really into looking at changing policing. I mean, a lot of people said to me, why would you want educated police? And I've even had police ministers say that to me and go, well, why would you not? And I think, you know, complex life we're dealing with, a lot more changes in our communities. You needed police officers who had all the skills of the old police officers, but a whole lot more as well.
I can remember being a teenager in the 1980s and the reputation, you know, a law-abiding teenager as well, you know.
Well done, Richard.
But, you know, sometimes dress up like a punk rocker every once in a while.
Right.
But the New South Wales Police had a reputation in those early 80s days. You could get thumped for no good reason by a New South Wales policeman in those days. So.
Well, and I think the interesting piece around that is that many people in the community think that's okay. And think it's all right that police should be able to do that kind of thing. And maybe there's your listeners are out there now railing at me saying, how dare she suggest that's not okay? You see, my problem about all of that is, how do you manage an organisation like that? How do you manage that it's okay for you to be kicked while you're on the ground? And can I kick you again and can I kick you in the head? And you can't manage an organisation like that. You've got to have rules, you've got to have standards, and you've got to have behaviours that you know, don't do that. And it says it's not acceptable that's the way we behaved. And I think what I've seen in policing over time and what I think this book tries to plot is that significant change of where we've come from to where we are now in policing across this whole country.
You applied for the job as Chief Commissioner of Police in Victoria and you got the job. Mm. Now, I remember when you got appointed to that appointment was announced. I'm a former Melburnian myself, and Melbourne is the clubbiest city in Australia. And you were put in charge as an outsider into the biggest, toughest club in the state.
Yeah.
You were put in charge of the country. How was your appointment greeted in the media?
Variously, actually. Some people were very positive, thinking that an outsider would be able to come, you know, with without any taint, without any connection to anybody. I think there was part of that. I think there were some who, you know, called me the lollipop lady, I think, from Wollongong.
Oh, and, yes, that's just a cheap shot.
Andrew
Bolt, I'm quoting him here, said, she may even do well, he said, but by choosing Christine Nixon, the government, they predicted, would instil a soft, feminised culture of police.
Yeah, I have to say the one thing about Andrew has always been consistent from the very beginning to the very end. And
How would you characterise your style of policing? Soft, feminised, I'm sure wouldn't be quite how you'd put it.
No, I wouldn't actually. I would characterise as a service model of policing, as one that is around attracting people from a range of backgrounds to join policing. To be able to work with local communities, you know, focus on what their problems are and look to help them solve those problems. When we have a big problem, like we had with the Underworld murders, to actually figure out what the best evidence is, who are the best people in the world dealing with organised crime, and then, you know, listen to their advice and go down those kind of tracks to try and overcome the problem we had and then prevent it from the future. So I don't think I ever saw feminised. You know, if feminised is about standards and limits and proper behaviour, then maybe it was, but I never quite characterised it myself like that.
The gang war in your time as police commissioner, you instituted the, well, I don't know if you instituted it, but I think you changed it into the Piranha Task Force into the war that essentially broke out between the shootings and murders that was going on.
Yeah.
It was an amazing time there.
It was.
Now, you said that what one thing Piranha achieved, aside from its success in prosecutions that it was able to conduct, was the new model of detective, hero detective, it brought. Tell me a bit about that, the new model and the old model.
Look, I think there was always that sort of, and we had some of the issues with the old models in, you know, it was the sort of ends justifies the means kind of argument in some cases, I think. And I've seen very senior detectives in New South Wales and Victoria, you know, argue that, listen, you know, we're tough and rough and we're allowed to associate with whoever we want because it's all about the job and it's all about getting things done and we need to be hard and tough to do that. And just occasionally if we happen to take, you know, money as well, then that'll be all right too. You know, that was the wrong model. And I think what we got with the Piranha Task Force and then eventually changing the crime department was a smart, astute, intelligence-driven police officer who made sure that they had the case pretty much sewn up before they went and got the body, so to speak. And I think that's the kind of change. And more people got attracted to do that in criminal investigation than had been to the other model, I think.
You shut down the drug squad and the armed offenders squad that was there in place in Victoria.
Yeah.
When it comes particularly to the armed offender squad, they're dealing with the worst kind of crooks in many ways. Like, these are people who won't hesitate to put a gun to someone's head and shoot or not shoot. And there's a certain kind of policing that you can't... Surely in pursuing these kind of crooks, you can't help but, you know, you gaze into the abyss and the abyss gazes back at you eventually. There's no getting away of getting in somehow tainted by the culture of that.
Well, I think there is, and I think that's the problem. I mean, you manage the detectives and you need to be able to manage within rules and boundaries and standards. And, you know, and you need to make sure that the way the evidence collected is admissible at court, because that's where you want to put them and you want to win the case in all of the proper ways. And, you know, I think that I've sort of listened to that particular kind of excuse. You know, it's a tough job and we need to be tough to do it. I'm not saying they don't need to be hard or they don't need to be strong, but they need to be within the law. And our community won't accept anything less these days. I mean, you'll hear the commentators in some cases will make comments about it, but in the end, the courts won't accept it. You know, in many ways, their families won't accept some of that behaviour either. And I think, you know, that's the piece that I watched when, you know, they arrested as many people, they didn't get the complaints, they got successes at courts. I mean, when all of those evidence, and then they go home at night. And I think, you know, that's what I saw, that sort of mythology that we've lived with through television programs and, you know, a whole bunch of things.
Yeah, well, you've actually got quite a generous description of that old style of policing. I'll just quote you back. You say, the old detective culture was about power and connections, pubs and clubs. They had an aura, those blokes. They consorted to get much of their intelligence, acquiring a swagger, a sense that they might be just a bit dangerous. Many of them worked hard in dark places, compromising their health and their families along the way. That's actually quite generous, I think.
Oh, it is. Yeah. And there were certainly the ones, you know, that I think were the ones who weren't corrupt who were behaving like that. I mean, that was part of the model. But I think, you know, the world moved on.
It seems like, despite your very strong record as a reformer, you've never met a Royal Commission you liked.
No.
There were calls for a Royal Commission into the Victorian Police, which has never had a proper Royal Commission.
No.
Never. It's the only one of our, I think, state police forces that never has. Why did you threaten to resign?
Well, I think it was in the early time, in the sort of 2003-04, around that era, actually, when I think we'd started the Piranha Task Force. We were, I think, on a track of trying to pull that together to try and get hold of what was happening.
Right, have a Royal Commission looking into the thing, and then that gives you all the more muscle, doesn't it?
Well, no, it doesn't. And you see, there's a piece here that I think we get confused about. What I thought we needed was stronger powers. And they were coercive questioning powers that easily the government could give us. They could give us more money.
What do coercive questioning powers mean?
You can force people to answer questions, and if they don't answer the questions, they can go to jail for not answering the questions. So it's a technique used all over the place, used in Australia obviously as well, and particularly by the crime commissions. So we didn't have that power, and I believed we did need that. I believe we needed more money and some other capacities to be able to improve and help us deal with the underworld.
If that's true, wouldn't a Royal Commission find that?
No, you see, what happens with a Royal Commission is you can get people who will give evidence and get out of, you know, they'll get indemnity. Lots of people who are crooks will go and give evidence about corrupt police and about a whole range of other things, and they'll get indemnity. What I had seen, and I'd said to the government, you know, we are working on reform here. I've listened to Fitzgerald, you know, Commission. I've listened to the Wood Royal Commission. I've watched commissions in Western Australia, and I know the kind of things we need to be doing, and that's what we're doing. And so let's at least give this a try, because if you bring on a Royal Commission, then the organisation will stagnate for the next, you know, 3 years, whatever time it runs, and we won't get the kind of people locked up, going to jail, that we did eventually.
Do you nonetheless regret threatening to resign over that?
Oh, look, I said to the government, I think the words are in the book, I'd consider it. And I think the government had to know I was serious about the fact we were on a reform process. I'd got a new team in place, good people had come and worked with us. And I think what would happen with the commission was it just would have stopped all of that.
We come to the Black Saturday moment. Now, you'd served your first term and the government asked you to stay on for a second term, and you were pretty much getting to the end of that second term when Black Saturday happened. Mm. That morning, the Premier was appearing in the media that Saturday morning, giving very dire warnings indeed, warning of Armageddon that day. Why don't you just tell me what you did that day and just go through that day, because this is really at the heart of this controversy.
It is, and well, basically I had been away travelling. So just a couple of days beforehand I'd been in the country and up Mildura way and then made my way back down. What I'd also done is talk to my own senior management, particularly Deputy Commissioner Kieran Walsh, who was the one prime responsibility for sort of the oversight of emergency management, and then Assistant Commissioner Steve Fontana, who was the Assistant Commissioner of Emergency Management. Talked to them about what we needed to do to get the organisation prepared. They'd been the ones involved in the city in doing those kind of things. We told all of our assistant commissioners, we put our police operations centres onto a footing, said you need to be ready to go, you know, if something happens on that day. And so we prepared the organisation along with, I think, the broader other emergency services to be able to be equipped to deal with it. From 6 a.m. that morning, I started to get texts from Steve Fontana and others within emergency management around a particular fire had jumped its containment lines in Druin and that kind of area. So what we did basically was to I listened to this. I got texts coming backwards and forwards, and there were various conversations along the way. I had already an appointment which I said was to go to a hairdresser, but there they had the radio on in the hairdressers and I was listening to it, and I then said, look, I need to go in. I didn't have the key operational role. I had a number of roles as the Chief Commissioner, and so that was oversight of police. I had the deputy role as the sort of coordinator for the emergencies, and the minister is the coordinator, and another aspect of a role. So I guess what I did was I then went in to see the police, see where we're up to, how things were going, you know, did those sorts of things as oversight and talked to my inspectors, talked to Assistant Commissioner. Everybody said, yes, it's going to be, we don't know how it's going to go. It's going to be terrible. It's a horrible day anyway. We're just not sure where this will all go. Starting to see fires break out and in different places. And so I then said, well, look, I'm here. I'm going to go upstairs to my office. I've got some things to do. I've been away for the week. You can come and see me. As you know, I had a woman come in who stayed for about 45 minutes who wrote this book with me. And I guess I was distracted. We tried to pay attention, but I said, look, I can't do this, I just need to go and make sure that everybody's okay. If they want any support, then I need to do that. So I did. Went back down to the police operations centre and the police emergency management centre we have, and then went up to the Integrated Emergency Control Centre up at, which is a distance away from police headquarters.
Were you giving orders at that point?
No, it's not a role about giving orders. It's, I suggested we need to bring one of our assistant commissioners back who was on leave because a particular fire had broken out and he was very well experienced in that area. So I guess it's not that kind of a role. I mean, it's a role where you make sure that things are in place, where you have good people doing the job who are more experienced in that and know each other and have been working together. And my role was really around support and encouragement, and I guess that's what I was doing. Eventually, we then started to see different fires. The Integrated Emergency Control Centre is a very interesting space, actually. It's one where, you're kind of isolated. There's not sort of lots of cameras out so you can see what's happening. There are a lot of people doing different jobs. The fire services were there, but they also had another control centre, another place. And so you kind of don't get a sense necessarily that now, in hindsight, lots of people have got this terrible sense to understand what was actually going on, and I particularly know what was going on now. But I have to say I didn't at the time. I mean, I knew there was a situation emerging, weren't sure what kind of implication that would have. I left and I got dropped home, said to the Assistant Commissioner Fontana, if you want me, you know where I am, call me on the phone, just keep me informed as time goes on. And of course, then eventually we obviously came to understand through the media and other information about 8:30, 9 o'clock. As the tragedy started to unfold.
So Later on in your submission to the Royal Commission, the Herald Sun newspaper said that you'd been evasive about where you'd been that night and going out to dinner. And in fact, I believe the editor has accused you of lying to the Royal Commission about that. What do you say about that?
Look, I don't think I did. I mean, what happened was 14 months after the incident, the actual Black Saturday, I was then called to the Royal Commission. They'd been hearing lots of matters, lots of people, all the police involved had given evidence, and I assumed mine was simply to do two things. One is to give evidence around, you know, actually what I'd done on the day or what had happened on the day and my roles on the day. And then the other would be to talk about the recovery and reconstruction, because I'd been given the responsibility as the chair of the Reconstruction Recovery Authority to head that up. And so I think I was there for two things. First statement, you know, was a very bland statement. Didn't really say a lot. It just basically went through the preparations we've talked about. I didn't go into details of where I was. I said I was you know, just simply said what I'd done and what the roles were and responsibilities. And then the other statement was very much in detail.
The Commission ended up recommending keeping the stay-or-go philosophy behind bushfires. Mm. You think that's a bad idea, don't you?
I do, yeah. I've spent the last 2.5 years out with these communities, and I think that it's a policy that some people who stayed and able to defend themselves, other people stayed and you know, were overwhelmed. I just think you have to have a far more educated community to really be able to put that policy into place. It's what I've said to anybody who asks me when I go out and see communities these days is just go.
Just go.
Just go.
You became the focus once these revelations were made, rightly or wrongly, of a fair bit of anger and distress around the bushfire. In your role there's the as the head of the Bushfires Reconstruction and Recovery Authority. Did victims of the bushfires vent at you, Christine?
Oh, they did. But that was, you know, an important part of the process. As we visited, I mean, you see, people, this is straight after the fires, and for that whole time, I was out with the communities for months on end, listening to them talk about how angry they were about, you know, what had happened and how they were going to figure out how to go forward. And I became quite close to a lot of those communities, visited them all, in fact, across the state for about 14 months. And of course, then we had the Royal Commission, but I then continued to work with those communities as I do now.
You do make the case in your book that the constant criticism of you kind of amounts to a kind of persecution of you. Some of it's quite pointed and bitchy. Some of it's a bit bitchy. Mm. Is this really persecution, though? I mean, this is the thing that most people claim these days. You know, you come under a lot of criticism.
Yeah, no, I understand.
Oh, I'm being persecuted here.
Yeah, no, look, I'm not saying that. I think what I wrote this book about was to try and just put the evidence out so people could make decisions themselves to understand some of the complications. But more importantly, for women particularly, I think, and others, to see that you can actually cope and you can survive, and as I have, and you can get on with your life and achieve things, even if there are a whole sort of bunch of people who don't necessarily want you to do that. And I think what I was pointing out in the book was some of that, but also more importantly, and you know, at the lessons at the end, which is that, you know, people can achieve and they can cope and they can get on with their lives. And you know, you take notice of the critics you have some respect for, and you don't take notice of the others.
You've still got a lot of time on your books at the moment. What are you going to do now, Christine?
Well, I'm teaching with the Australian New Zealand School of Government on leadership and women. I'm doing some mentoring. You know, I talk in the book about sliding doors. You know, one door shuts, another one opens, and I'm just kind of pushing different paths at this stage.
Coles?
I don't think so. I think they're doing pretty well on their own.
Christine Nixon, fascinating to talk to you today. Thank you so much for being my guest in conversation.
Thank you, Richard, for having me. It was terrific.
You've been listening to a podcast of Conversations with Richard Feidler. For more information and interviews, visit abc.net.au/conversations.